to qualify for the federal.
Right. Just assume, yeah.
The House Committee on Revenue for April 22nd will come to order. And we have two bills for public hearing today, and we'll take them in order. We'll start with the public hearing on House Bill 2069. Chris?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. 2069, as you recall, as drafted, puts a cap on the additional medical deduction for elderly taxpayers and takes that revenue and dedicates it to senior disabled services. You have in your packet two pieces of paper. One is a dash one amendment, and that's actually a three-page amendment that replaces the policy in the drafted 2069. And then you have a handout labeled HB 2069-1 policy, which is a couple of tables that I put together to just summarize the changes contained in the dash one amendments. And fundamentally, it steps away from the policy of putting a cap on the deduction and moves to a phase-out based on AGI, as well as increasing the eligibility age from 62 years to 67 years once every other year. And then the phase-out starts, according to, you can see in the table there, starts for single AGI of $60,000 and federal AGI $120,000, phases it out by 20% chunks. So as income increases, there are steps where 20% less of the deduction is allowed until it's phased out for single filers with income over $80,000 and joint filers over $160,000. The Dash 1 amendment also provides a little more detail on the funding, where the revenue gets spent, and it directs it to be spent on Oregon Project Independence, the property tax deferral program, and then services for seniors and persons with disability. And a preliminary revenue estimate for the 09-11 biennium is about $50 million.
Great. Representative Cowan is here. Please.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jean Cowan. I represent House District 10 on the Central Oregon coast. And I'm actually here today just to try to make myself helpful, if possible. I think that the general concepts, and I not had a chance to go line by line through the amendments and plug them in, but in general, the concept that I and others have supported is to put some amalgamation of the bills that relate to the senior medical exemption together in a form that would, first of all, graduate the reduction and recognize income eligibilities and that sort of thing, which this bill probably is the one that does the best, and then specifically protect that money in a way that it can be reinvested in seniors programs, which probably those smarter than I will need to take a look at these proposed amendments. On the first cursory glance, I would think that they would accomplish that purpose. We don't want to get really, really specific, partly because Ways and Means would prefer that we not tell them exactly how they're supposed to spend the money, we find. But certainly into that general concept of services for seniors and people with disability. And the reasoning behind that is that there's a goal of expanding the use of that funding beyond simply the existing Medicaid-funded services for seniors, which we'll need to try to protect as much as we possibly can through this challenging budget climate, but also to begin to address in a more proactive way the needs of individuals who might be classified as pre-Medicaid, or those individuals who, with the wrong choices, I'm careful to use that word, but in the early days of the challenges of aging and the decline into needing assistance, if the first step is to a skilled nursing facility or a nursing home, that is very costly, and it's going to exhaust someone's reserves very quickly, probably putting them into a classification and needing Medicaid services or state-funded services at a much higher level much more quickly. Instead, we know that we have a whole system out there of community-based in-home care and alternative care services that are available to individuals that can extend their own personal resources a lot farther. And if we can find ways to be helpful to individuals in sort of working through what their individual challenges are, and that's a very individualized conversation. That's the reason that staffing is needed to within our area agencies on aging or whatever other structure that we might come up with, but individuals who have time to spend with individual families and really talk through what their needs are. It isn't a quick conversation. If any of you have aging family members who you've worked with within your own family structure, I think you can appreciate what I'm saying when I say that it isn't something that you can just sit down and say, all right, let's fill out this form, and we've got A, B, C, and D here, and we'll take care of it, and then we're going to move on to this. It's difficult for people to process this sort of information and decision-making at a stage in their life when this is really of critical importance, and it simply can't be done quickly. So we need some folks to help people work through that, talk through that process, and ultimately make wise decisions which will result in the best place for them to be cared for and also to extend their resources. And that's kind of the concept behind what we've been trying to do and put together legislation and programming that needs resources. So these are the resources we're looking to, and hopefully put that with some parameters around it so that we can use those funds in a proactive way, stretch people's nest egg, and help them make the best choices for themselves and save them state money in the long run. Because if we go the opposite direction, we're going to be expending a lot of state money real soon as this whole demographic moves through the aging process. So that's the concept behind what we're trying to do, and I'm really here just to answer any questions if there are any.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Cowan? We have been through this concept a couple of times already, and I think it is fair to note and emphasize yet again the kind of peculiar nature of this deduction that we're working with, which gets larger the more money you make. The other thing I would note that we haven't noted yet, is that these numbers are actually much larger. The deduction phase-out amounts are actually much larger than they look like, because the Oregon Constitution says that we cannot tax Social Security income. So most of the people who would be falling into these categories actually make quite a bit more money than these numbers indicate, because this is related only to taxable income. So the monies that you would get from Social Security are not covered there. So if you stick another $20,000 or $30,000 in there, you'll get a more accurate number of what household income actually would be before these cutoffs apply. Is there anything else for Representative Cowan? So we'll let her go back to committee.
Mr. Chair, I might add just a bit more. You make a very interesting point, and this particular exemption is kind of unique in the fact that someone attains it by the virtue of having managed to live past 62, as opposed to it being in any way related to what the income level in the household is. And then at the same time, we have I didn't mention specifically the Oregon Project Independence Program, but in the amendments that is mentioned, as well as a way to refund, if you will, the property tax deferral program, which is suffering right now. Those things all come together really nicely. Although Oregon Project Independence, which allows people to stay in their home with a little bit of assistance, is probably not something that should be funded solely on the backs of the property tax deferral fund, and that's part of the conversation that we're having. But that funding is available to individuals who, by virtue of income and age, are allowed to defer the property taxes on their primary asset, being their home, And as the funding in that declines and that's not available, that would be a sad day as well. So it's important the way this, all of these programs mesh together, and it's going to be have to be very carefully constructed, I guess, to make the whole thing work. But I simply wanted to point out that all of these are on the radar screen as we try to develop it to make whole and stable the property tax deferral account and its availability to individuals who would choose that direction to make whole and preserve Oregon Project Independence, which is a program that is very valuable to individuals in our community, and then expand that conversation into other ways that we can be of assistance to people in making good decisions.
Thank you. And, of course, it also makes sense for those same people to be able to qualify for the property tax deferral. It doesn't do you much good if you qualify for OPI and lose your house for taxes. Keeping that revolving account solvent means we're able to maintain that that program as well. So they do fit together in that way.
They fit together. The Oregon Project Independence Trust Fund has been sort of the recipient of, if you will, the excess from the Property Tax Deferral Fund, and then those funds have been used for Oregon Project Independence. So I think what's key and critical here is that folks who understand this a little better than I make sure that the proper verbiage is in there, that the money is protected in the right fund or whatever else you want to call it, so that we can preserve that money for senior programs.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else for Representative Cowan? Thank you very much. We really appreciate your coming and giving us this summary this morning.
Thank you. Anytime I can be of assistance, please let me know.
Thank you very much. Peggy Woolsey.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Representative
Riley.
I wanted to wait until she's gone because this, I didn't want to hold her up. She has to go to committee. But for staff, one of the things that you said was Social Security would not be part of this. But I read, at least in the handout, that it's federal AGI. And isn't Social Security part of federal AGI?
Representative Riley, a portion of Social Security income is included in AGI. For all the Social Security benefits an individual receives, depending on their income level, some of that is taxed at the federal level and is included in AGI. I believe the part that the chair was referring to was a portion of Social Security not included in AGI.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
What portion is that? Good morning,
yes.
Chairman Barnhart and committee. My name is Peggy Woolsey. I'm recently retired from the Department of Revenue. I spent many years educating the public on this deduction, and I've been looking forward to taking it this year because this year is the year I turned 62. However, in this economic downturn, I think it's part of our shared responsibility to start cutting back on tax expenditures, and this is a tax expenditure. The common belief is that retirees are poorer than the general population. Census data does not confirm this misconception. 8.7% of people age 65 and older are under the poverty line. 25.9% of single individuals 15 and older are under the poverty line. 14.9% of families with related children under 18 are under the poverty line. Another thing to consider is how many senior citizens are using this tax break. According to census data, there are 477,682 Oregonians over the age of 65. Yet, only 215,000 over the age of 62 are taking this deduction. We already provide a tax advantage to senior citizens. The 2008 standard deduction for a single person is $1,865. For a single person over 65, the standard deduction is $3,065. In the median income in Oregon is $50,000. So I don't think that this amendment goes far enough. I think that the amendment should reduce the allowable percentage starting at $50,000 with a phase-out at $70,000. Why increase the qualifying age each biennium? Why not increase it year by year, therefore reducing the numbers that can claim this as time goes on, especially in view of the baby boomer population, which is going to swell the senior population very soon? And because I'm a member of that population, I feel like I'm qualified to speak to this. This is a good bill to consider separately from other income tax bills. I would not want this bill to destroy a recession funding solution. And the other thing to consider is that Oregon is the only state to offer this deductions, and I wonder how other seniors in the other 49 states get by. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions for Ms. Woolsey? Thank you. We appreciate all that information.
Sure.
Is there anyone else who wanted to appear this morning on House Bill 2069? Yes, sir. Please come forward.
Want may be too strong a word, but for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations, AARP, Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of comments, to some extent reiterating previous testimony I provided to the committee on this bill. As I've indicated, our current taxation principles for considering various tax issues and so forth, the current deduction is in conflict with those principles, particularly related to equity and the reality that we believe that benefits, a deduction of this type, should be based on a person's income rather than solely on their age. So I appreciate your the attempt made in the amendment to consider a person's income. I also appreciate the wording that you're in the amendment that tries to more clearly indicate the intent of those funds that might be recaptured by this bill, and that the use of those funds still be used for the benefit of seniors and people with disabilities. I think your point related to the property tax deferral program is a good one. The fact is that utilizing the surplus funds in that program to support Oregon Project Independence has considerably diminished the reserves in that fund, and I think it's appropriate that if this bill were to go forward, that some of the proceeds from it be used to replenish that property tax deferral program. With that, I'll conclude my remarks and answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Bennett? Thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony. Colleagues, of course, as we work on a bill like this, the portion of the bill having to do with the expenditures is in the area that peculiarly belongs to the Ways and Means Committee. And even though this bill does not have a subsequent referral, that would be my proposal, that we get the bill into the shape we want it in, and then send it to Ways and Means for their action on that portion of the bill. Is there any other comments about that issue or any other this morning, Representative Brune, and then Representative Brune?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for Chris. Chris, on page 3 of the original bill, lines 5 through the bold, lines 5 through 15, it looks to me like that is an inflation adjustment factor, and I want to make sure that jives with the Dash 1 amendments. So you have your, specifically with the deduction phase-out, I mean, the question is that inflation adjusted over time within the bill?
Representative Brune, the language that you're referring to on page 3 needs to be deleted. And I guess it's a policy choice, but that inflation adjustment pertained to the $6,000 cap in the original bill. And so if the committee moves away from the cap and it gets back to the 7.5% piece, I don't know that an inflation adjustment fits with that notion, because it's really whatever doesn't.
Well, I guess my question would be, so nothing in the dash one amendment, you've outlined the set of numbers beginning with less than 60,000 at 100% and capping out at 0% at over 80,000. That will be permanent statute. Nothing in the amendment inflation adjusts this. So 30 years from now, we'll still have the same dollar levels at that point.
Correct.
Unless the legislature adjusts it, of course.
Right, which I would advocate we consider.
Right. Representative Berger.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if this isn't a tax increase that would require a 36 vote.
You know, it's not in the bill, is it, at this point?
No, and I'd like to hear from legislators.
I, of course, given my usual response to that kind of question, say that the Constitution doesn't actually require that, but I think LC's opinion would be the same as yours. We have to do at least one other amendment on the bill, and we'll inquire about that issue when we ask them to draft that amendment.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? I don't see any. All right. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2069, and we will open the public hearing on House Bill 2214. And I think Steve is on that. Yes. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2214 deals with the forest products harvest tax. The rate is set for 2 years, and so every session the legislature reviews the rate and comes up with a new one. So what House Bill 2214 is doing is extending it for another 2 years for calendar years 2010 and 2011. The current rate is 92 cents per 1,000 board feet for the Forest Research Lab at OSU, and it's certainly $1.14 per 1,000 board feet for the administration of the Oregon Forest Practices Act. What you have in the bill are blanks for those rates, and so it's there's no impact until those blanks are filled in.
We have a witness list.
Oh, yes, you do.
Thought we might. Okay. All right, let's hear from Clark Seeley and Hal Solwasser. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Colleagues, while they're getting settled, let me simply note for those who are new that this is a bill that comes before this committee every year, and we get to learn about the intricacies of issues having to do with forest health and fighting fires. Gentlemen.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. I'm Clark Seeley, Associate State Forester with the Department of Forestry. Dean Hal Solwasser is joining this morning as well, and we'll both provide a few comments this morning and then answer questions that you might have. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2214 this morning. The bill, as your staff has indicated, amends ORS 321.015 to establish the forest products harvest tax rates for calendar years 2010 and 11 in support of both the Forest Research Laboratory at Oregon State as well as the Department of Forestry's administration of the Forest Practices Act. For the Department of Forestry, with the Forest Practices Act, the harvest tax is actually combined with general fund to administer the act in a 60-40 ratio, 60% general fund, 40% harvest tax, to recognize benefits provided and the obligations of both the general public and forest landowners for resource production. The tax rates in the bill are established on a per 1,000 board foot harvested basis, and they're calculated considering three factors. One is the current biennium ending balance of our fund, of our harvest tax fund. The budget for the next biennium for the Department of Forestry's Forest Practices Administration, and then the forecasted harvest levels in the state for the next 2 years. Got a couple of attachments in my testimony this morning. The first one, attachment one, shows the history of the harvest levels in the state over a number of years. And as you all know, based on federal policy enacted in the early 1990s, harvests in the state have declined, primarily because of those choices and decisions on federal lands. Attachment 2 then shows the history of the tax itself, with the various components of the tax included, and shows the rate changes over time. The harvest in the state has been relatively stable over the past 6 years or 10 years or so, up until, of course, the recent economic situation. And we're currently forecasting a harvest level for next biennium of approximately 3 billion board feet per year in the state. And that's down nearly 28% from harvest levels 2 years ago, where we were at approximately 4 billion board feet per year. Again, the rate is collected, as you know, by the Department of Revenue, and actual receipts are transferred to the Department of Forestry and the College of Forestry on a quarterly basis. We have one more quarter to receive revenue yet this biennium. That'll occur the middle of next month, and at that point, of course, we'll know then our full receipts for full actual receipts for this biennium. Again, that's one of the factors that we plug into the formula. And then secondly, of course, the big decision is the budget decision from the legislature. And because of that, this bill has typically taken a pathway that has it end up in the Ways and Means process to be then considered along with budget bills at the close of the session. So with that, Mr. Chair, again, appreciate the opportunity to testify today and be glad to answer any questions that you have.
Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Hal Salwasser. I'm the Dean of the College of Forestry and also the Director of the Oregon Forest Research Laboratory at Oregon State University. And I also appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2214. I'm going to briefly describe the programs of the Forest Research Lab and how we use revenues from the harvest tax to guide our work on behalf of Oregonians. I also have some appendices to my written testimony that describes the value of forest resources to Oregonians and the FRL and its history. The Oregon Forest Research Laboratory delivers most of the new forest resources, science, and technology to the state. Our researchers work on nearly every aspect of forest resources, from tree genetics to forest soils, tree growth, forest watersheds, water quality, fish and wildlife habitat, forests and climate, forest management, forest recreation, timber harvesting and transportation, wood products, engineering, and high-tech wood-based composites, the use of wood in green building and the green economy, forest policy and economics, and the human dimensions of forest resources. It's the most comprehensive academic forestry program in the country. The harvest tax supplies about 12% of our total research funding. It's an approximate match to the FRL appropriation from the general fund, although in the last couple of years it hasn't quite matched as the total volume harvested has been down. When we combine the FRL appropriation and the harvest tax, it supports the salaries of our faculty and some of the support staff, who then apply for and get largely federal grants, about $12 to $13 million worth a year. So the harvest tax and the FRL appropriation are leveraging two outside dollars for every dollar that the state or the forest landowners put into the program. And that $12 to $15 million creates jobs for research faculty, research assistants, and students, and it also supports the purchase of equipment and supplies for the research program, most of which are coming from Oregon companies. The FRL delivers knowledge and information about some of the key foci that we have right now is the effectiveness of contemporary forest practices in protecting water quality and fish native fish, the development of non-toxic adhesives for use in interior panels to improve air quality in homes, the roles of forests in climate change, fire risk reduction strategies for federal forests, and better uses of wood products in green building. As the director of the Forest Research Lab, I support House Bill 2214. I welcome the opportunity to work with the Legislative Assembly as the revenue and budget processes move forward. Given the current uncertainties in those, we're not prepared to recommend a number for the blank spaces in the bill at this time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Questions for either of these gentlemen? Do we have an idea of when we're likely to have a number for these for the various blanks in the bill?
Chair Barnhart, again, we'll have our final turnover of harvest tax revenue for the current biennium from the Department of Revenue by the middle of May. That will firm up our ending balance, essentially, for this current biennium, which is one of the factors we use. And then our forecast level, forecast harvests for next biennium, are essentially calculated at this point. We may adjust it in a minor way in the next month or two, but essentially we think we know the forecast for the harvest levels. So the third component is the budget decision for the Department of Forestry and the college. And given whenever the budget decisions are made, then of course we can run the calculations and plug the numbers into our calculation and determine a rate. For us, the rate is actually relatively mechanical, just taking those factors into consideration and producing a rate based on the budget and the balance in the fund. So biennial budget timeline, obviously June would be the point where then this bill could be considered in ways and means along with the budget bills. That's the process, at least, that's been used the last couple of sessions.
And does the department and or this budget have a time scheduled for ways and means review?
We have Mr. Chair, the Department of Forestry's budget hearings are scheduled to begin next Monday and then complete the week of May 11th. So our hearings will be up relatively soon, and then, of course, work session.
But some of the basic information won't be available until later.
That's correct. That is correct. And particularly, Mr. Chair, because of the fact that for us, the Forest Practices Program Administration, again, is a general fund harvest tax combination, and the general fund is actually the larger share of that. And general fund reductions being considered right now are significantly taking general fund out of the private forest program, the one that this bill supports. So that's the current nature.
Right. Thank you. Other questions for this panel?
Chair,
yes,
Barnhart,
please.
Let me just comment that in the case of the Forest Research Lab, the harvest tax is a self-imposed tax by the forest landowners. That they did this to support research that is a benefit to them. And so we will work very closely with the people who pay that tax to figure out what that number should be.
Yes, and of course that's one of the reasons why it sunsets every biennium and why we go through this process each biennium, so that we can look at current factors in determining what that would be.
Absolutely.
Thank you. And I really appreciate that there are five members of the committee who haven't been through this process before, I think, so it's useful to be reminded.
Good.
Thank you.
Good.
Thank you. Ray Wilkerson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. Ray Wilkerson, representing the Oregon Forest Industries Council, which consists of almost all of Oregon's private and industrial forest landowners. And for purposes of this bill, I'm representing the taxpayers, or most of the taxpayers. Clark Seeley did a good job of outlining the program and the history and the process of how this bill comes before you every 2 years. Just a couple of other kind of data points that I don't think have been mentioned. The bill that passed 2 years ago was, just in terms of total dollars, to give you an idea of the scope or the magnitude of this tax, was designed based on harvest projections at the time to raise about $8 million a year for these two programs, or $16 million for the biennium. So that's kind of how big the breadbasket is for this bill. And one other, Mr. Salwasser just mentioned the relationship between the general fund and the harvest tax for his program, the Forest Research Lab. That's not set in statute like the forest practices one is, the 60-40, which is a statutory ratio. There's no precise number legally prescribed, but traditionally, historically, we try to agree on a harvest tax rate that basically matches the general fund appropriation, so it's a 50-50 proposition. As you correctly noted, Mr. Chairman, this is kind of a ritual. Every 2 years we do this, and normally we get up here and say three things. We say these are very important programs. We say that we will remain willing to help pay for them, and then we say that we support the bill. Unfortunately, this time we're going to have to be a little bit off of that theme. We can stick to the first one consistently. These are very important programs. The Forest Practices Act was the first of its kind, and Oregon was the first state in the nation to adopt a Forest Practices Act. It's one of Oregon's most important environmental laws. It provides assurances to the public that environmental resources are protected on forest land, both public and private, and we very much support it, and it's very important to us and to the state. For OSU, there, by any objective measurement, the College of Forestry at Oregon State is the number one forestry school in the United States, and we should all be proud of that, and we need to maintain that. And so our support for both these programs has not diminished one bit at all over time. The problem right now is that our industry is experiencing the worst market conditions in its history. Our members are hemorrhaging red ink. Thousands of people have been laid off. Mills are closing. And our industry is looking to cut costs anywhere it can, and it's pretty grim, some of the things that are happening. And as a result of that, I'm duty-bound to appear before you today and say we cannot support this bill at the present time. We hope to be able to by the end of the session. And let me try to explain what that apparent contradiction means. There are other things going on in this building and other programs that need to be addressed related to the forest industry. You mentioned in your opening comment the fire issue, Mr. Chairman. That's not directly affected by this bill, but indirectly it's tied to it. Forest landers have experienced rapidly escalating costs in Oregon's program to maintain a fire protection suppression program, and we are looking this session for some relief from those costs. This is not a good session to be doing that, given the budget situation, but we're doing it anyway because that has become a very severe problem for a lot of forest landowners across the state. There's a couple of pieces to that, and we are expect to have a final debate about that in the Ways and Means Committee towards the end of the session. It's possible, at least, given the pressures on the budget, that we could fail in our efforts to obtain that release, and even worse, that the powers that be down there will try to shift additional costs onto the forest landowners to free up general fund dollars for some other program. That is kind of a doomsday scenario, and we hope it doesn't happen, but if it does happen, we might be forced to ask when this harvest tax bill goes to the floor of the House to say, you know, we can't, this is just the straw that breaks the camel's back, and we can't afford it, and ask that it not be passed. And this is a 3/5 vote, by the way, Mr. Chairman. So it's just kind of a grim message, but I wish it didn't have to be that way. But it's a function of the situation we find ourselves in, and it's by no means a reflection on either one of these programs. But you know, we need to have some sort of a resolution of the broader issues before the session's over with to be able to support this bill as we normally do. So thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. questions for Mr. Wilkerson? Everybody knows all about it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I do appreciate very much your blunt assessment of our situation. You've described it, I think, pretty well, and I was wondering if we were going to get to that point. And I appreciate the fact that you described the dilemma that both the people who you represent and also the people who we represent
right.
face.
Right. We're very grateful, Mr. Chairman, that members on both sides of the aisle, the House and the Senate, are listening to us and understand our plight, and I think are genuinely committed to trying to arrive at a place where, you know, we can live to testify at this bill 2 years from now.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard this morning on House Bill 2214? Well, I misjudged the amount of work we could get done today. Colleagues, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2214. And similar to yesterday, you get an extra hour for other work. Committee is adjourned. What do you think about